In October 2014, during the Peace Through Music World Tour, in the Brazilian city of Curitiba, the Playing for Change band performed a magical night of music in front of a sold-out crowd to benefit the creation of a new Playing for Change Foundation music school in the community. The song Stand By Me certainly expresses our sentiments here at Solutions to Violence. If you believe in peace, if you believe in justice, as does our guest today, Hardy Merriman, come stand with us.
Welcome, friends. We are Forward Radio, WFMP LP 106.5 FM. And you're listening to Solutions to Violence, a program out sponsored by Forward Radio. Forward Radio is a subcommittee of the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation. You're going to hear more about that in just a moment. I'm Jamie McMillan, here with co-host Jim Johnson. Our technical engineer is Carolyn Brooks Johnson. The following is part of WFMP's public affairs educational programming. The views expressed are those of our guests and not the station. If you would like to share your views, you may contact us by sending an email to solutionstoviolence18@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. If you enjoyed last week's broadcast, we're sure you're going to enjoy our broadcast today because it's our pleasure to have our guest back, Mr. Hardy Merriman, for a return on and a second interview. Welcome back, Hardy.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hardy Merriman has worked in the field of civil resistance for 18 years and is president and CEO of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. He has presented at workshops for human rights activists and grassroots organizers from around the world. His primary interest is in how ordinary people organize themselves, strategize, and mobilize to overcome adverse conditions, hold power holders accountable, and win rights, freedom, and justice. Mr. Merriman also presents about civil resistance movements for academics, journalists, NGO members of international organizations, and develops educational resources on this subject. He feels history is replete with cases where unarmed resistance was successful against powerful and entrenched adversaries. The questions that guide his work involve understanding what makes such cases successful and how to apply these lessons to nonviolent movements today. He began his work in this field at the Albert Einstein Institute, and that's a nonprofit founded in 1983 by Dr. Gene Sharp. Did this advanced study to use a strategic nonviolent action in conflict. Merriman has directed the James Lawson Institute in 2013 and 2014, and from 2016 and 18, he was adjunct lecturer at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. That's at Tufts University.
Again, folks, we want to remind you this is the second part of a two-part series that features Mr. Hardy Merriman. It is our pleasure to have with us again, Hardy. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The topic of our series focuses on civil resistance, demonstrations, and the right to protest. We at Solutions to Violence, as does our guest today, Mr. Merriman, believe in the right to peaceful protest and the right to redress our government with a list of grievances, not only because of its constitutional right, but also because it's a cornerstone of any democracy. Also because nonviolent civil resistance has been proven as a method for ordinary people to organize themselves, strategize, and mobilize to overcome adverse conditions, hold power holders accountable, and win rights, freedom, and justice. Research conducted by Erica Chenoweth and others demonstrate that 50% of the nonviolent campaigns succeed when only 25% of violent insurgency succeed. For this reason and others, we here at Solutions to Violence, as well as our guest today, Mr. Merriman, believe that civil resistance should be peaceful. In addition, Hardy Merriman believes that demonstrations and civil resistance are more likely to succeed if their leadership has acquired skill in organizing, communicating, strategizing, planning, and effective methods for convincing the political leadership that alternatives to the status quo is not only possible, but preferable. If you missed our first discussion with Hardy Merriman, we strongly suggest you give it a listen. You can find the first Hardy Merriman interview on our website. Just visit us at forwardradio.org, scroll down to the program archives, then scroll down to the Solutions to Violence program that features Hardy Merriman number one. So Hardy, is that summary, does that sound about right to you, or you need to add something to that?
Oh, thank you. No, I thought it was great. I would just add, you know, in my definition of civil resistance is always nonviolent. And as you said, it's peaceful. But peaceful shouldn't be confused with not being disruptive. A lot of movements succeed because they engage in nonviolent actions that are actually quite disruptive. They're peaceful because they're not violent, but they may be disruptive even though they're nonviolent.
What's a disruptive movement that's nonviolent? An example.
Sure. Like, for example, if you do civil disobedience and you were to, or, you know, an occupation of a particular building, those would be quite disruptive. Even a labor strike, for example, is quite disruptive, but it remains nonviolent.
Okay.
All right, you believe in nonviolent protests, peaceful protests. Some might even label you as an anarchist, but you believe that civil resistance is patriotic. Is our democracy like America representative? Why is it civil resistance if necessary?
Well, I've never thought of myself as an anarchist, and I think my work has focused on how people can hold unaccountable institutions and corporations accountable. When ordinary people are being oppressed, what can they do to fight back that's not going to involve violence? And so, you know, civil resistance has been a major way in which this has been done worldwide, and particularly in the United States as well. And so, yes, in a sense, I mean, it's outside of traditional institutional means. If you're going on a labor strike, you're not necessarily, you're not necessarily using the legal system or the voting system to try to get your voice heard. If you're doing mass protests, you're, again, going outside of traditional institutional means of change. But often the result of that is to actually get institutions to work again and to be more accountable, to be more responsive, to be more just and humane, to recognize your rights as a person. And, you know, when I look at the United States and our history, and again, look at everything from the women's suffrage movement to the labor movement to the civil rights movement, to, you know, ACT UP, raising awareness of HIV/AIDS, movements for gay rights, movements against war, movements for the environment, movements for recognition and rights for disabled people. There's a whole anti-nuclear movement. Civil resistance has been used again and again to make people's voices heard when institutions were not responsive. And in many cases, I would argue, have strengthened our democracy, have really helped achieve things that voting alone could not achieve, or that the legal system could not achieve. So its record in U.S. history is actually often standing up for the principles and rights and traditions of U.S. life that we're proud of.
Let me ask Hardy a question here before we get to this next question. You know, that word anarchist has been thrown around by the current presidential administration to describe those people who have torn down statues, Civil War statues, statues of people who were determined to be blatantly racist. So in terms of that word anarchist and what has been happening with some of the demonstrations that have torn down statues, tearing down those statues, does that fit within your definition of peaceful civil disobedience?
It's a great question. I mean, again, just to be clear, I don't consider myself an anarchist. And so I think that term is used in many different ways, and I don't even have a working definition of that term. But I think the question of property destruction is a question that every movement has to deal with and think through. And there's no one single opinion about it that I think is necessarily, that is categorically going to suit every single movement. So civil resistance consists of acts of commission where people do things they're not supposed to do, not expected to do, or forbidden by law from doing, like protesting when you're not expected to protest or where it's against the law. Acts of omission where you don't do things you're expected to do or required to do, like pay taxes, or you divest from a bank, or go on a consumer boycott, or go on strike. And so then this question, okay, well, but where does property destruction fall? Property destruction doesn't necessarily fall in what I'm talking about with civil resistance. There's a lot of distinctions to be drawn that I think, a lot depends on context.
So civil resistance can be considered as patriotic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you know, civil resistance is a force. It is a force that we know throughout history has often expanded democracy and rights and justice. You know, it could be used in ways that don't do that, but generally speaking, it has done that. And so, yes, when used to expand rights, freedom, and justice, I would consider it quite patriotic.
If civil resistance is going to be effective, then the leadership possesses certain skills. Can you tell us what those skills would be?
Sure. Well, I think making change is a team sport, right? If you want to go from a situation where certain population is being exploited, abused, oppressed, their rights are being violated, and institutions are not addressing it, and elections aren't changing it, and the legal system is not working to address it. What do you have to do? You've got to organize people. You've got to listen to them in order to organize them. You've got to try to build coalitions. You have to possibly do a public education about the issue to get it on the agenda. You have to be good at message development. You might need to be very good at, you know, getting media coverage and getting your message out there, or building your own, you know, media culture outside of that, for example, through social media. You have to have deep knowledge of your issue. You have to have knowledge of related issues too, because if you want to build coalitions, you've got to figure out where your issue intersects with others. You have to recruit people. You have to train them. You may have to manage a budget. You may have to manage volunteers. These are just some. You have to be able to negotiate. If you want to ultimately get legislative change, you're going to need to be able to also interface with insiders and reformers at some point within the system to try to get your changes enacted in policy. So these are just some, you know, and by the way, you'll probably also need to be good at solving internal conflicts, because every time you get people to try to come together on a goal, there's going to be conflict, which is normal in human life, but it has to be managed well. So these are just some of the skills that activists and organizers need, and no one activist or organizer is going to have all these, right? Again, we come back to change is a team sport, right? You need lots of different skills. Activism has many faces. It's not just the people who are necessarily leading a protest. There are many other support roles that can be played. They're important. They may not all be important at exactly the same time. You may not, in the beginning of a movement, necessarily need certain skills as much as others. But as you grow, as you build towards your goals, suddenly skills that you didn't need 3 months ago might become quite useful. So this is why I think, this is why we emphasize this so much, because you know, these are the kinds of skills we've seen that have made a difference in other movements in this country and around the world.
So recruiting would be a pretty important part of that if you're talking about teams, right? And listening and learning those kinds of skills if you don't have a person that is confident in those, right?
I think that recruiting and training is one of the most important things a movement does. You know, I was talking to a good friend of mine who is a longtime activist, a very successful activist from Serbia and trains people around the world, Ivan Marovic, and Ivan told me, you know, when you do a protest, people sometimes think, well, the target of the protest is a particular institution or person being protested, right? He said, but actually, you know, another way to think of protest is to actually think that the prime audience for this protest is not the person you're directing it at, it's the general public. It's in trying to create an opportunity for them to see what you're about to join in. So the goal of protest may well be to get more recruits and train them and get more people to join your movement than to necessarily force the person or institution that you're up against to change their mind. Chances are a protest alone won't do it, but it may very well get you a lot more supporters, which can be a really critical step in ultimately making change.
You know, a lot of people complain that protest doesn't really accomplish much. If you don't have all those elements of an effective protest, do you think that's what actually keeps or creates the possibility that the protest doesn't go any further than just a street gathering?
Yeah, I mean, so one of my former boss and a sort of key thinker in the field, Dr. Gene Sharp, who's now passed away, said there are three categories of methods of nonviolent action. He used the term nonviolent action, I use the term civil resistance. We mean the same thing. So the first he called it a protest of persuasion, and these are primarily symbolic acts, where an acts where you gather to voice your grievances, and also articulate alternatives, if you have alternatives that you want to articulate. And those have the power of alerting, you know, people to an issue, putting it on the public agenda, building popular support. But by themselves, they're often not sufficient to make change. So the next category Sharp talked about is non-cooperation, where people literally just stop cooperating and withdraw their consent and obedience from the status quo. And this, there's a huge range of ways you can not cooperate, right? There's social non-cooperation, of stopping certain social behaviors, they could be cultural or religious or otherwise, that are expected of you, and shifting those. And then there's economic non-cooperation, which is massive, right? There's every time we spend money, we're engaging in some kind of act of cooperation. So if we shift that, you know, if thousands or millions of people start shifting the way in which they engage economically, or how they conduct their jobs, that can have a major impact. And then there's also political non-cooperation. And then the third category is nonviolent intervention, which was like directly actually trying to stop something from happening. So civil disobedience, blockades, occupations of buildings. And many people, and myself included, would talk about a fourth category, which is alternative institution building, where you actually try to create alternatives to institutions in the status quo that are corrupt and not serving you. And so when we talk about civil resistance, the first image that comes to our mind is often that of people protesting. And that's, of course, because it's the most common image there is, and it's what people tend to do. It's what the media shows us you can do. And it's very intuitive. What should we do? We should get together and voice our grievance and talk about what we want. But the basis of civil resistance is that if people shift their behavior patterns in targeted and strategic ways, they can shift the balance of power in society. And a lot of that comes through non-cooperation. It comes through building alternative institutions, and sometimes it comes through nonviolent intervention too. So there's actually a whole range of different actions that people can take. And so successful movements often have to develop a whole range of different tactics they can choose or actions they can choose depending on their circumstance.
Sounds like if you want to do a protest, you need to do quite a bit of training first.
Well, yeah, I mean, training is one of the most important things. I mean, because when we think about what makes a movement, it's easy, you know, many of us virtually all of us, I assume, have grown up under some form of hierarchy, right? Whether it was the way we were schooled, maybe it was just the way things were run in our house, when we go to a job, there's always this hierarchy. And so we have this, it's easy to think, well, how is strategy set? Strategy is set when people at the top who have power decide what they want to happen, and then that gets passed down, and then in the end, the people at the bottom have to sort of go along with it. Or, you know, if you're an employee, you could refuse and risk getting fired, or you could refuse and then you could get offered a raise, and then you take the raise, and then you go along with the plan. But that's sort of like, it comes from the top down is the general model most people have to think about strategy. It's how political parties often function too. But in a movement, there's not necessarily a command and control structure, right? If you want to get thousands of people to join you, millions, voluntarily join you, take their precious time, possibly incur some risk to try to do something, they have to feel that they're stakeholders in what's happening, and you can't necessarily command and control them what to do. If a movement's leadership gets out of touch with the base just votes with their feet and stops showing up, and suddenly you don't have a popular movement anymore. And so what is this sort of, how do you solve that problem? How do you keep thousands or millions of people on the same page so they're all pretty much going in the same direction, but they can't be commanded and controlled? And there's going to be local actions they're going to do that are going to be customized and tailored for their particular circumstances. But you're also trying to build sort of a common direction at a state level or national level. And one of the key linkages there that helps those people work together voluntarily is training. It's building a culture within a movement where people have a sense of, here are a few key principles of how we organize, what we do, we remain nonviolent, we resolve internal disputes this way, and deal with that so that we don't crack from the inside, and build up from there without necessarily, again, having this top-down committee control structure. Training is really critical for this.
Yeah, so in your 2019, quote, Minds of the Movement, end quote, article, Lessons of Uprising Around the World, your position is that recent protests reflect the growing trend of new civil resistance movements that go back almost 30 years. Can you give us a sense of that history?
Yes, I mean, so the numbers are pretty powerful on this. So Erica Chenoweth has done some great research, and she looked at one data set called the Major Episodes of Contention data set, which basically looks at a whole range of kind of uprisings and challenges around the world. And in particular, one thing it looks at is the number of new nonviolent movements that emerged. And so if you look at the 1990s around the world, you say how many new nonviolent movements there were that were trying to challenge a government at the national level. The answer to that question based on this data set is about 28. And then if you look at the next decade, 2000 to 2010, 2009, and you say, okay, how many then? The answer is there are about 53 new ones. And I don't have the exact number for how many there were between 2011 and 2020, or 2010 and 2019. But I know that by the middle of the lesson, by 2015, we were on track for close to 100. For that decade. So you're seeing a doubling number of new movements every decade going back to the 1990s. And these are just movements that are trying to change a government. If you were to look at local movements for various reforms and various labor struggles, you would find vastly more. So the numbers tell us right now that there are more and more movements emerging worldwide. And that leads to the question, okay, why? Well, why do people use civil resistance in the first place? I mean, if people felt they could solve their problems simply by voting, they'd probably vote, right? It's a lot easier. If they thought that the legal system was going to really represent, work for them to meet their needs, they'd probably just rely on the legal system. So what this tells us is that people are losing confidence that institutions alone of the state are going to be sufficient for them to get their needs met, for them to get their rights recognized, for them to get justice and accountability or freedom. And so that's one thing it tells us. Another thing, and this isn't surprising, by the way, because we know there's a documented trend of rising authoritarianism and backsliding democracy in the world. And this goes back for the last 14 years. This is documented by an organization called Freedom House, but others have documented it as well. So authoritarianism's rising, freedom is declining, democracy is declining, and as a result, more and more people are rising up and trying to challenge that. Now, what's really remarkable, is, in my opinion, is that when people rise up, they have a choice, right? They don't have to engage in civil resistance. They might be violent. But it seems to me that there is a growing recognition that people have that civil resistance is going to be more effective. And that's pretty remarkable. People are choosing this more and more. And I think that's really amidst some really depressing trends about rising authoritarianism, it's actually quite hopeful that so many more people are now engaging in civil resistance.
Yeah. Hardy, you co-authored Right to Resist with Peter Ackerman. That focuses on preventing mass atrocities from a responsibility to protect a right to resist. Campaigns of civil resistance. This is an outline of needs for nonviolent civil resistors. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So the field of civil resistance, there's been a lot of new research over the last 10 years. It allows us to make a bunch of statements and have a lot of confidence in them. And so one is, as you alluded at the beginning of the show, that civil resistance movements have been more effective at particularly challenging authoritarianism and unaccountable government than violent insurgency has. So they've been more successful, these nonviolent movements. And we also know that after a nonviolent movement succeeds, it's much more likely to lead to a democratic outcome. So when you have a big national nonviolent movement, as there was, for example, last year in the country of Sudan, a highly authoritarian government had been there for decades, a nonviolent movement ended that and is now trying to transition the country to democracy. When that happens, the probability, the chance that there's going to be a democratic outcome after that change of government is much higher when it's been driven by a nonviolent movement than, say, toppled through a coup d'etat or toppled through a violent insurgency. We also know in general that if you have a more democratic world, you're going to have fewer interstate wars, you're going to have fewer humanitarian crises, you're going to have less human rights abuse, you're gonna have less corruption. This doesn't mean democracies don't do bad things. It doesn't mean democracies don't have their own human rights abuse challenges, their own issues with corruption, and wage their own wars. I'm simply talking about, on average, if you have a more authoritarian world, you're more likely to get some real deeply challenging violent behaviors and hurtful and damaging behaviors in the form of corruption, for example, than if you have a more democratic world. So if that's the case, if sort of one of the strongest drivers of democracy is civil resistance and the world's sliding towards authoritarianism and authoritarianism is going to lead to more violence, how do we deal with that? And so my colleague Peter Ackerman and I said, what would it look like if there was an international doctrine, if there was an international guidance around how to support nonviolent movements that are struggling for rights, freedom, and justice? What would that look like? We have all kinds of international agreements, but I don't know any that focus on how we could support movements. There are agreements that focus on how you can support human rights, but not movements per se.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we developed this idea called the Right to Assist, which lays out sort of five different ways, a five-part typology of helping, how international groups can support civil resistance movements around the world, and we published it. And it's very tricky to do something like this. You have questions like, well, if you want to support movements, well, what are the criteria you should have if you're going to support a movement? Are you going to support any old movement, or do they need to meet certain criteria? And how can you be sure if you're trying to support a movement that you're not actually hurting them? Because sometimes international support could be hurtful. And are you concerned that if you're supporting movements that, for example, that might actually make the movements more vulnerable, because then the host government could claim that look at these outsiders trying to support them, we need to squash this movement. And so there's all kinds of good and challenging ethical and moral and strategic questions about how you do this. And we dive in the report into looking at both, like, what's the case for supporting these movements, what are some options for doing it, and then how do we deal with the illegal and ethical and strategic considerations of doing it.
Yeah, so Right to Resist, that suggests a more vocational style of education for activists, one that could be implemented in schools, professional associations, unions, clubs, religious groups. Why vocational? What can that change about nonviolent resistance?
Well, you know, one thing that is that the research increasingly points to is that skills and the strategic decision-making of movements matters hugely in their outcomes. And that might sound obvious, but actually a lot of analysis has focused in the past on, you know, has really not emphasized the choices that a movement makes. They emphasize, well, if the government's really hard or tough, or the government uses violence, or there's a certain level of, for example, you know, poverty in a country or ethnic tension in a country, then a movement can't win. And that's actually not true. Increasingly, research shows that that's not true, that actually you can have movements emerge in really tough circumstances where most people would assume it's impossible, and they still, and they win because they're strategic and they're skillful. So that's really good news, because strategy and skills can be learned, they can be taught, they can be developed, right? So if an activist comes to me and says, well, I'm up against a really tough government, and my view is, well, if tough government's tough enough, you're just not going to win, I really have nothing useful to say to them. But if I say, look, actually, what we see consistently is governments like the Bashir government in Sudan fell when ordinary people who were nonviolent, and that movement in particular was largely organized and led by women, confronted and defeated a dictatorship of 30 years, it's pretty powerful. And so I talked earlier about what are some of these skills that are useful. And, you know, there's really just not enough educational infrastructure to support activist learning. If we were to compare activism and organizing as a vocation to any other vocation or profession we can think of, right? So compare it, say, to a doctor, an engineer, a soldier, a lawyer. You know, all these other vocations have a whole set of educational infrastructure developed, building knowledge, skill building, getting the latest research and bringing it into the field and teaching it, and mentorship for people who want to learn, and professional associations for people to share views and ideas and strategies, and then people go and practice and continue to learn in their vocation, and they're paid for it. We take that as standard for most vocations. And yet for some reason, activists and organizers who have one of the most important jobs in the world and one of the toughest jobs in the world don't have this infrastructure available to them, right? And so it's pretty remarkable that activists and organizers achieve as much as they do by their own ingenuity, their own creativity, their own grit, their own determination, their own resilience. What would it mean if there was more infrastructure for them, if there was more support for them to tap into around learning, creating mentorship relationships among activists, making sure that research gets into their hands? And I'm not just talking about the U.S., I'm talking about internationally. I mean, a lot of my work is focused internationally, and, you know, that we do a lot of translating simply to try to get ideas out there that might be useful to people in parts of the world where normally they would have no access to that because the research has been done in English and it costs too much and it's not free online, or their government's actively trying to stop them from getting that information. So we think that if, you know, one of the most important things you can do if you want to support human rights and democracy is support opportunities for activists to learn. It's not actually really that complicated. It's pretty fundamental when we think about it, that activists around the world need this, and we need to give them the respect they deserve and try to provide these opportunities for them.
A friend of ours, Coleman McCarthy, a Washington Post journalist, he's retired, but he also teaches a course in public high schools in Washington, D.C., as well as American University. He named his course Solutions to Violence. His is much like focus on Gandhi, civil rights movement, that sort of thing, Martin Luther King. Coleman graciously allowed us to name our program Solutions to Violence after his course. And I think he teaches peace, but I'm not sure he teaches high school and middle school students ways to solve conflict on a domestic or international. But why this group? Why do you think this group needs to be taught how to solve conflict, not only on a personal level, but on domestic and international levels?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think also I would put it this way. They need good conflict resolution skills. They also need to know how to wage conflict, but do it constructively and nonviolently. right? Because we're not going to be able to resolve certain conflicts until they're actually fought, until they're actually waged. But if we do it nonviolently, we're going to do it with a lot less damage to people in general and a lot better outcomes. And so people need to learn, yes, how to negotiate, how to listen, how to separate people from problems and focus on interests and not just positions and do all this, you know, good work of conflict resolution, and also know how to fight when they need to, but do that fighting nonviolently. And, you know, I think if we look at the way in which, you know, many people are socialized, and by many I really mean, you know, the vast majority presumably, is that violence is seen as the highest form of power ultimately, right? So, you know, in the English language, the word force, when the word force is used in international affairs, we had to use force, or even domestically. Force is seen as a synonym for violence, right? As if violence is the highest force, or maybe even the only ultimate force. It's simply not the case. In entertainment media, this idea that violence is you know, the highest form of power is also very prevalent. Or that, you know, money and accumulating wealth is the highest form of power. And so, because this isn't in fact true, I mean, if this was really where power comes from ultimately, you wouldn't see nonviolent movements win, would you? Because if what we learn from the way history is told, from the way news sometimes reports, news media sometimes reports, and from what entertainment media tells us, there's no reason why ordinary people being nonviolent should be able to beat dictators. And yet it happens. It happens a lot more often than people think. And so people need to learn a much more accurate and deeper understanding of power, and that actually all of us, through our actions daily, our consent and obedience and behavior patterns, are doing little sort of micro interactions where we are creating what we call the status quo. We're creating society through our small interactions, through going to school on time, going to work on time, buying certain products, having certain goals that we want to in life, watching certain shows or going to certain websites, or all these small little things that we do that add up ultimately, obeying orders when they're given, and so forth. And people need to learn that actually changes happen when people discovered that power was possible, when they got together with a group of people and changed these behavior and obedience patterns. And I think young people especially can find this empowering. I think young people sometimes have an easier time understanding this because, you know, this is something that intuitively, as 4 and 5 and 6 year olds, they understood. They understood the power of their own disobedience, that if they, you know, really didn't want to go, you know, shopping with their parents or something, or really didn't want to go on a walk with their parents, that they could try to do all kinds of behaviors and maybe get something out of it. You know, they could refuse, claim they couldn't find their shoes, they could, you know, refuse to eat the food they didn't want, and eventually they realized they might be able to get something out of that. So it's actually like deeply ingrained in human behavior to do what we want to do and not want to obey something that we don't, and it gets socialized out of us. And I think it's important that kids see that actually there's some real value in that basic human impulse, and that it can be used strategically. And one other point I'd make is for kids to understand their own power. It's not just the power they'll have as adults, it's the power they have right now. Point I've made before is that corporations want to build brand loyalty among young people. Most young people don't realize how targeted they are by advertising to try to build that brand loyalty. Brand loyalty is incredibly valuable to corporations, which is why they spend so much time trying to get kids really invested in a brand at 12 and 14 and 15 and 18, because they know that conveys into money. And if young people, for example, realize that that's part of what's going on and said, you know what, we're going to shift our buying patterns, or shift the patterns that that we, you know, ask our parents to have, that could actually be incredibly powerful.
Well, you know, when you mentioned the actions that particularly younger children use to get what they want, they're basically nonviolent. And then taking those examples to the older students can possibly make them aware of how effective they can be. So we could learn from our our youngest how to be nonviolent.
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, if you're trying to deal with 3 disobedient kids, it's a lot harder than dealing with 1. So, and especially 3 disobedient kids who are all working together to disobey you, and they have a strategy. This is at the basic level, seeing the power of this. And the key thing that people, I think the jump for folks is realizing that actually this is incredibly powerful when we all get together and use it in really targeted, clear ways that have a strategy behind it. That's when it really has the power to change nations.
So, Hardy Merriman, protesters are adapting, says Professor Don Brancati, a scholar at Macmillan Center for International Studies at Yale. He's taught Nathan Law, one of the leaders of the movement in Hong Kong. Brancati has said civil resistors in Hong Kong have learned how to keep a movement cohesive, how to evade the police, even as demonstrations spread. So what does he mean by protesting, protesters are adapting?
So we can see movements and the movement's adversary as engaged in an exchange of tactics, right? So if you had, we'll use an analogy, right? So I'm a big basketball fan, and I'll look at the strategy that two teams come in with, and I'll look at the adjustments they make along the way. And so sometimes you have one team that does great in the first half, other team, you know, at halftime really figures out what the counter strategy is and starts to come back in the second half. And sometimes you'll have back and forth each quarter as each team makes adjustments each time to each other. And that makes a great competition. And, you know, in activism, it's not really that different, right? So activists may do something, authorities learn what that is, respond to it, become better at dealing with it if activists keep doing the same thing. So the authorities respond, and the activists have to innovate and respond. And it's what we call a tactical interaction. So if a movement gets stuck in a cycle of protest where they keep doing the same kind of protest in the same place, in the same manner, at the same time, the authorities get pretty good at dealing with it. And eventually, it generally loses effectiveness. This isn't always true. There are actually exceptions sometimes where a movement does the same thing consistently all the time to show how powerful and resilient it is. But in general, movements up against a bureaucratic structure, and the bureaucratic structure moves slowly, but once it learns how to move and once it learns a game and once it develops a system for responding, it's pretty effective. And so this is why innovation is so important. And I'll give one of my favorite examples of this. When I teach sometimes, I use this example to illustrate tactical innovation. So in Australia, in the late 70s, in 1977, in the province of Queensland, the premier there got angry that so many people were protesting against the uranium mining industry there, among other things, that he said that we're not going to have any protests in Queensland anymore, which is not happening. They're illegal. He tried to rule by decree, which, of course, you know, went against the law. But nonetheless, he basically said we're outlawing protests in Queensland. So what do activists do at that point? They did three quick innovations. And the first one was called the No March. And the No March involves students telling police, we are going to march. We're going to all meet in the university quad, and then we're going to go on a march. So we'll be there at, 10 in the morning. Hope you're there. We're going to break the law. You'll be there to stop us. So 10 in the morning, the students all come to the quad, get together, say, yep, nope, you know what? We're actually not going to march right now, but why don't you stay here, police, because we'll be back in an hour to march. They come back in an hour. The same thing. Say, actually, not now, but maybe next hour. And so this is an example of tactical innovation. Now, think about this from the perspective of the costs of the state and the protests. The protesters, what's the cost to them? A bit of their time. They come out, they go back to the dorms. They come out, they go back to the dorms. What's the cost to the state? You have police who are gathered. I don't know if you've been to Queensland, but it's often quite hot there in the heat, waiting for these students, realizing they have to stay there, but they're never really going to be able to leave because the students can just pick and choose when they're going to come back. And these police may have been getting paid overtime. It starts to be draining. This happens day after day. So this is an example of tactical innovation. Then there was another tactical innovation done, which was called the Border March, where people gathered in the adjacent province of New South Wales and said, we're going to march into Queensland. And so cops be there at the border to arrest us. And once again, they'd march right up to the border and then they'd just stop. And journalists would be sitting there waiting for them to get arrested. And they all had signs just saying Queensland is a police state, but they never marched across. Police just had to wait. Amazing media coverage. And again, showing this real brilliant sort of creativity to make it very costly for the government to take this ridiculous position that protest is illegal. And then a third innovation they did was an example of a man who actually went and told police, I'll be marching in a sugarcane field at 2 a.m. And the police actually showed up to arrest him, and he was with his dog. And it was like ridiculous. It's like dog had a sign saying like dogs can march too or something. And they actually got arrested for this. And then they had to release him because it was so ridiculous, and he ended up doing talk shows, going on talk shows talking about what had happened. So this is a dynamic that we call backfire, where through various tactical innovations and various effective use of media, the movement actually made the repression much more costly for the oppressors than for the movement itself, and tactical innovation is often a key part of that.
Okay, so Hardy, you've talked to us about Professor Eric Chenoweth of the Diplomatic Center, Harvard professor. She's collected systematic data with different authors from 10 years. According to her research, from 1900 2015, about 50% of the campaigns of nonviolent struggles succeed, compared to 25% of violent insurgencies. So in 2016, her question has become, why is nonviolent resistance on the rise?
I mean, I would echo what I said earlier about the few reasons. A growing understanding among people that civil resistance is more likely to succeed than the alternatives. It certainly beats waiting around for things to get better, and it certainly beats engaging in violence. So that there are really powerful ways to fight nonviolently, and that understanding is growing around the world. And, you know, that's, you know, for me, I think that's incredibly hopeful. It's also rising because of people are losing faith in institutions, and that their governments and corporations are going to be held accountable, and so they need to find other ways to try to do that. So I would point to those as two key factors.
Well, you have mentioned that it's hard to address in a soundbite the wave of 2019-2020 largely nonviolent protests and media coverage. International landscape is complicated, and the differences between many uprisings this year are just as interesting as they are alike. What are some thoughts on this phenomenon?
Well, particularly in 2019, we saw a lot of movements towards the end, throughout the year. I mean, it was almost too many to count. I mean, Venezuela, Hong Kong, Iran, Chile, Sudan, Algeria, it went on and on. And I think, so what do these have in common? I mean, and what's different about them? Well, I mean, every movement has a local, and of course, the United States as well last year, and this year. So, you know, every movement arises in a local context, right? So for some, it could, in that context, there's deep grievances. Could be related to economics, could be related to race, could be related to police brutality, could be related to corruption. The treatment of women, democracy itself, or the lack thereof. And so that local context matters, and that's going to vary and be different places. And then there are these trigger events. Could be an incident of police brutality, as we've seen in the United States numerous times. Could be a rise in the price of bread. Could be a new tax, as it was, for example, in Lebanon last year. They said they were going to do a new tax on various forms of digital communication, and this sparked an uprising. And so when the media shows up, sometimes they'll focus on this trigger event. But actually, there's deep grievances underneath that, because a trigger event by itself is enough. There's got to be deep grievances to really get people out. You know, and then I think, you know, in terms of where these uprisings go, you know, a lot depends on how united they remain, how strategic they remain, and whether they remain committed to nonviolent means. So at the end of last year, when I would speak with journalists, there was a lot of questions, where does it go? And, you know, right now there's people, you know, when I was answering questions last year, it was people would say, well, right now there's uprisings going on around the world. And maybe some of the images of them look the same. I mean, maybe a protest of 500,000 people in one country looks similar to a protest of 500,000 in another. But that doesn't mean they're going to the same place. That doesn't mean they're going to look the same 3 months from now. What it really depends on, again, in my opinion, is people's ability to remain united, people's ability to be strategic. And by strategic, that could mean very well doing a protest now and doing a boycott later, and then doing another sequence of tactics subsequently. Whereas if another country, there's just a cycle of protest, it's going to lead down to a very different road. And then again, this commitment to nonviolent means, because quite simply, remaining nonviolent increases the chance that they're going to succeed.
Okay, so Rupert Shenoy, reporter for the World Public Radio International. Rupert also created and hosted the podcast Otherhood, based on the World Newsroom. In December 2019, Shenoy stated, "Nonviolent protest defines the decade." Does it really go that far? You've talked about several nonviolent protests that are succeeding, but that's a bold statement.
Well, I mean, difficult to say any one thing has defined a decade necessarily, but I would say the nonviolent movements have had a defining attribute in many countries around the world. Absolutely. I mean, the documented rise in civil resistance is a major force around the world. You know, when I talk to people who are focused on international relations and international affairs, my basic position is, if you want to understand the world, if you want to understand and interpret what's going on in the world, you can't afford anymore not to understand civil resistance. It's not enough to understand just who the particular presidents and prime ministers and governing people are in a certain country. It's not enough to understand the economic forces. It's not enough to understand, you know, all this sort of top-down stuff. Who are the key individuals and corporations and institutions of power? You have to be able to understand how power works also from the bottom up. You know, civil resistance rises constantly, and I've seen it. It surprises people when it does, because they tend to look at a country from the top down. They tend to look at who's the head of state, what do they want, what's their ruling party like, and as if that really is the primary thing that matters. But movements consistently surprise people, because at the bottom, when you look at the bottom and you start to see, okay, there's been increasing low-level tactics and nonviolent action going on for several years, and I'm starting to see new groups showing up in protest, you can actually predict. You can say, wow, this place is probably going to see a nonviolent uprising, so you got to know where to look. And this is going to be more and more important for people to understand, because these movements push back and they change things. They change things powerfully. I can't underscore, you know, I'll use another example. You know, in the 1980s in Chile, the government of Augusto Pinochet was considered stable. It was a government where Pinochet was extremely brutal, widespread use of torture, disappearance, and atrocities.
Had the support of Richard Nixon.
With U.S. support, and the Pinochet fell to a nonviolent movement. How that happened, you know, it's so, even back then, you needed to understand something, but I think now even more, you're just going to be, it's just essential to see how these movements can shape events, and they will continue to do so.
Cardi, Rupa also quotes, this is your quote, Cardi, we see an increasing number of movements at the same time that we see documented decline in democracies around the world and an increase in authoritarianism. Is that correct? And
yes.
Give us expand that a little bit for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to do with, you know, rising authoritarianism means that people don't think that their elections and legal system are going to work for them. It means that they have experienced that, you know, backsliding, and it means that the option to try to wait it out doesn't seem like a very good one. If the direction things are going is not in a good direction, saying let's wait to see where it gets better is not really viable. And so increasingly we're seeing people say we have to find a way to push back. We can't simply rely on institutions to do it. And they're waging civil resistance. And you know, I would say as someone who runs an international organization dedicated to this field and dedicated to building educational infrastructure and share knowledge about it, that the demand just rises practically every year as more and more people want to get more acquainted with how to engage in nonviolent struggle and figure out how to win.
Hardy, the recent civil unrest in response to Black Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Trayvon Martin killings, has resulted in large nonviolent demonstrations around the U.S. And amazingly around the world. There have been a number of positive responses by government power centers. Some of these responses have resulted in renaming city streets, naming a fountain in memory of Breonna. Policies banning police chokeholds, restraints, and body cameras for police. There's even a law banning no-knock warrants. They have been more government threats to limit protests and action. Some of them seem appropriate, but others are rather short-term, autocratic, even frivolous. What part of your work focuses on helping promote substantial, permanent change in response to peaceful protest demands?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, movements often have to persist for years to not just make change, but consolidate it, but really, you know, and really get it incorporated into the way that things are done. That's an ongoing struggle. It's we say victory is a process, not an event. And, you know, I think movements have to, in the broadest terms, achieve two things. They have to defeat what they're against, but they also have to win what they're for. And there's two phases in every movement. I look at a lot of movements against authoritarianism around the world, and they have to defeat an authoritarian and then get a democratic transition. So the struggle goes on. You think it's just about getting the dictator to step down. It's not. It's also very much about building something next. And so that's a multi-year process. It requires commitment. It requires also we talked earlier about the skills required for activism and organizing to be successful may be in different demand at different times. So if you're in, you know, and when everyone said, when people say, by and large, we recognize now there's a problem. We didn't before in the same way, but now many of us do. And in fact, we support you and want to try to get change. Then the legislative process and that policy process becomes more important. And that's a different arena to win in. It involves activism for sure, to keep issues on the agenda and to push for alternatives. But it's also it's tricky because. And when we get into issues of legislation, there are always trade-offs. And so the challenges to a movement's unity may be experienced differently in that second phase, when some people say, look, this is the best legislation we can get, and others say, no, we need to keep pushing. So that's something that generally happens to movements when they are making progress. And, you know, that sustained commitment is needed, that continuing to build and strengthen the coalition, that continuing to bring in other voices, to welcome in other skills, to try to keep that strong for that next phase. Understanding, of course, that, you know, one of the ways that people who don't want change will try to thwart it at this point is to say, yes, we recognize there's a problem, but don't you realize all the alternatives are worse? So at this stage, authorities tend to try to scare people about alternatives. And the movements have to not just, now that there's widespread acceptance that the problem exists, be able to articulate alternatives in a way that goes, that overcomes some of the fear-mongering that's going to go on.
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, and it's not all fear-mongering. I mean, there could be rational points about, well, maybe this policy is not, you know, we need to shape it more. So I don't mean to necessarily make all opposition fear-mongering, but there certainly is going to be some very cynical attempts to create fear, we know this, over policies that should be enacted.
Yeah. So construction is a big part of that. According to Stellan Bethagen's book, A Theory of Nonviolent Action and How Civil Resistance Works, what you were talking about is staying with it and creating alternatives and helping construct those alternatives or that one alternative, right?
Right. It's two different sides of the same thing.
So you have to stay with it and you have to build in addition to protest.
Yeah, I mean, most people are not going to be for change if they don't know necessarily what some of the details of that change are going to. Most people know when something's wrong and when they need change. So that's, they don't necessarily need to know every detail about what the change is going to look like. But when it comes time to enact into policy, of course, that's essential to develop that. And you know, that's something movements need to stay engaged with. It can't just be left to political elites who then say, okay, thanks very much, we'll enact the change you want because, you know, we'll take it from here. The movement has to be very good at continuing that engagement, and it's a tough balancing act.
Another part of the training.
You can tell I love training, so yes.
Okay, Hardy, unfortunately, we have come again to the end of our time with you. In closing, would you suggest some authors, readings, lectures, or other sources that our listeners could access if they want to know more? Or would you be interested in conversation with our listeners? Can they contact you? Or,
sure.
And if so, how might they do that?
Sure. So you can reach me through my website, hardymerriman.com. There's a place where you can contact me there. I welcome your thoughts and to connect. And then in terms of resource, I mean, there's so many good ones. So for further reading or viewing, I mean, my organization, the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, our URL is nonviolent-conflict.org, has made several films available online for free viewing. So if you go to our website and you'll see one of the menu options is ICNC Films, you can see a film called A Force More Powerful, which is, we've actually got it in English, but also I think 20 languages in total, and it's for free streaming. And it's got examples of successful nonviolent movements from around the world over the 20th century. I highly recommend it. We also have another film called Bringing Down a Dictator that might be of interest, about the movement against Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia in 2000, or 1998 to 2000.
What was that name again?
Bringing Down a Dictator. There's several other films too. We have a film about Truth and Reconciliation Commissions called Confronting the Truth, movements about the revolution in Ukraine in 2004 and the uprising and revolution in Egypt in 2011. We have a blog called Minds of the Movement where we focus on everything from key research findings to trying to elevate activist voices and highlight movements around the world. Again, that's called Minds of the Movement. It's on our website. Waging Nonviolence is also a good source of stories and information and news. I believe that's wagingnonviolence.org. you know, there's a great organization, Momentum. Go to momentumcommunity.org, which is, they do a lot of training workshops. I'd recommend people to look at Erica Chenoweth's TED Talk, which I forget the name, but if you, the exact name, but if you Google Erica Chenoweth TED Talk, you'll find it. There's so many great options. I mean, Shaska Byerly, a friend of mine, wrote a great book on movements against corruption around the world. It's called Curtailing Corruption. It looks at a really critical issue that I think doesn't get enough attention and focuses on how civil resistance can address corruption. So there are many, many others. Feel free to contact me on my website if people have particular needs or ideas about what they'd be interested in following up on, and I'm happy to make more recommendations or referrals or to engage.
Our conversation today has been our second in a series with Mr. Hardy Merriman, President and CEO of the International Center of Nonviolent Conflict, also ICNC. We look forward to future conversations on civil resistance and conflict without violence. We hope with you, perhaps with Mr. Merriman again. So thank you once again for joining us here at Forward Radio. You can listen to Solutions to Violence live stream by visiting us at forwardradio.org and choosing Listen Live Now. You can listen to Solutions to Violence live stream by visiting us at forwardradio.org and choosing Listen Live Now. We air Solutions to Violence on Mondays at 5 p.m., Tuesdays at 8 a.m., and Wednesdays at 6 a.m. There are two programs that feature Hardy Merriman. This one will be placed in our archives July 7th. To listen via our archives, visit us at forwardradio.org, choose Program Archives, and scroll down to the Solutions to Violence programs that feature Hardy Merriman. If you'd like to share your thoughts about our discussion with Mr. Merriman, you can reach us with the following email, solutionstoviolence18@gmail.com. Until next time, please keep the peace in your own personal way and help others do the same. Thank you for listening.